This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
It seems like you can't turn on the radio or read a health blog anymore without finding something else that will eventually kill you. Sunshine, artificial sweeteners, natural sweeteners. There's no escaping it. They're all gunning for you. But according to a new book, it's even worse than we thought.
There is no winning. There is absolutely no winning. Everything can kill you.
On today's Health Show, a conversation with an author of the Encyclopedia Paranoica.
Then we'll head to the Bronx, where work is being done to help people with asthma in low-income housing. And we'll hear why making critical healthcare decisions should be a collaborative effort. I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Health Show. Cake, fruit, armadillos, Santa Claus, rubber duckies, New Smyrna Beach, Florida, and gray goo. According to the new Encyclopedia Paranoica, these are all things that can and eventually will kill you. The book is the brainchild of authors Henry Beard and Chris Cerf, two of the founders of the legendary humor magazine The National Lampoon. And while the book is certainly tongue-in-cheek, every entry has been painstakingly fact-checked. After looking through the book, I was a little afraid to get out of bed in the morning. Here to talk about the book is co-author Henry Beard. And Henry, what were you guys trying to do with this book? Scare the hell out of people or just make them laugh?
Well, primarily to make people laugh. I mean, I think that as we continued our researches, it just becomes apparent what I'm sure you notice reading in the newspapers or reporting on the radio. Day after day, you get these extraordinarily, fundamentally contradictory pieces of information about health, well-being, and all the rest, diet. One day you're told, gosh, leave that hamburger alone. Eat soy. And the next day it turns out soy has some problems. You're supposed to avoid French fries. Let's have some bean sprouts. But it turns out that one of the big E. coli breakouts is called a sprout break by the Centers for Disease Control because it is so commonly associated with leafy greens.
This book, I mean, and it is hilarious, is actually a fact-checking masterpiece. How much research went into this?
Well, a great deal. And again, we have to give credit where credit is due. Without the internet, this book would have been virtually impossible. We would have had to spend decades in libraries checking and cross-checking. But the great thing, and perhaps the troubling thing today about the internet, is you could right now go onto Google and type the two words cushion and hazard, and you'd probably be directed to a website like www.cushionscankillyou.com. You can find every possible interrelated source of information on things, some of them more reliable than others. And we were very strict. The 50 pages of references we have in the back to the various websites, all of those websites have some actual capacity for accuracy. I will admit that some of them are a little self-interested, but we point that out whenever we think it occurred.
If anything is taken from this book, the one thing I think that everyone will get, that is anything that has ever been touched by another living being is suspect and could kill you.
And this is the problem, of course. We actually put together a lovely little video showing Chicken Little, the famous bird who warned that the sky was falling, getting caught in a public restroom because every time she went to wash her hands, she realized that the faucet she touched were covered with germs. If she tried to use the air dryer, it turns out the air dryer circulates germs. Obviously, you go near the bathroom itself, you're in a world of hurt, and you can't leave the bathroom because you'll have to touch the door handle, which has been handled by everybody else and is covered with germs.
Well, and it turns out in the end, according to your book, chicken can kill you too, so there's just no winning for her.
There is no winning. There is absolutely no winning. Everything can kill you. And I think one of the lessons, if there's a lesson, and you're right, this is basically a tongue-in-cheek, not knife-in-the-back book, is don't overreact to every single thing that's reported. I mean, just very recently, since the publication of the book, we've learned that either aspirin, which we know in a daily dose has considerable demonstrated benefits, can either hurt you by causing macular degeneration or further protect you by keeping you from getting melanoma. Now, which is it? Both? Neither? Well, after a certain point, you sort of have to rely on common sense and a general idea of where the preponderance of established opinion rests.
It's almost impossible to read this book one page at a time, because when you read about one thing, it gives you references to another portion of the book. And one of my favorite references was, as you read through leprosy, at the end it says, see armadillos. I mean, okay.
Yes, I mean, who'd have thunk it? Turns out that armadillos, which are a native New World creature, nevertheless turned out to be one of the very few creatures that can actually spread the Old World disease of leprosy because of the curious architecture of its blood. So, I mean, well, I don't think you're going to go out, as some people apparently do in the Southwest, and pick up roadkill armadillos and roast them on the barbecue. But if you do, think twice.
And, of course, rubber duckies, they're deadly.
They're deadly. Here's this harmless bath toy, but of course, like all bath toys, it's been in the, guess what, bathroom. Mm. So its capacity to contain and spread germs is almost unlimited.
It's really an enjoyable read. And you, and for your career, I mean, you've had a long career in writing, and it's almost exclusively been in print. Is that just something you just never wanted to leave that medium?
Well, I think it's just a more of an accident history. I mean, I came along, I'm 67, I came along at a time when print was still very much alive. I mean, it still is both in its normal form and electronic form. But it just turned out that way. And because I was lucky enough, along with my co-author, Christopher Cerf, to have started the National Lampoon magazine, once you go down that road and start writing enormous amounts of what is supposed to be funny stuff, I guess you're going to get stuck in it.
And you guys, you've done a few books together. The Politically Correct Dictionary and Handbook was a masterpiece.
And we feel a very helpful guide to everybody who, you know, doesn't want to say old. You want to say, you know, chronologically challenged. And it just goes on and on. We also collaborated on the Book of Sequels, which provides happy endings to almost all the sad pieces of literature around, like, you know, Romeo and Juliet and Moby Dick. So, yeah, we've been at it for a while.
And we won't even get into French for cats right now. So Santa Claus, New Smyrna Beach, and Bowls of Cherries, all deadly. Forget about them.
All deadly. I mean, Santa Claus in particular, because he's such a bad image for kids. I mean, the guy is clearly obese. Never mind the fact that when he goes ho, 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 which is apparently scary to kids who would prefer ha, 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 he's spreading germs that were passed on to him by the previous kid who sat on his lap and gave him his list. And the bowl of cherries, of course, the cherries contain pits, and you know what pits can do. It's just terrible.
Well, it seems, you know, you get on Santa Claus for being obese, so he should eat healthy, but apparently all fruit is deadly, too.
Just about every fruit we encountered, whether it was the problem of pesticides or some inherent chemical makeup of the fruit itself, seems to have some problem. I mean, it's just crazy making blueberries, strawberries, every berry you could possibly imagine, apples, the skin is a problem. It just goes on and on. But, of course, we would quickly add that compared to what and how many apples and blueberries you have to eat. So it's you have to keep a sense of proportion, though. We don't do much, frankly, to help you keep that sense of proportion.
Well, with things changing, do you see an update coming in a couple of years?
I must tell you, honestly, I have already been, and Christopher Cerf have been collecting new stuff because, as I said, even in the very few months since the book has been published, I mean, there is a study that seems to suggest that overweight people live longer than skinny people. Hard to believe. There's a new study that has been, not new, but recently rediscovered from Australia, that suggests that eating traditional bad-for-you saturated fats, you know, burgers and hot dogs, is actually healthier than eating polyunsaturated fats like sunflower seed oil, which seems completely preposterous. But once again, the statistics are there, and you choose to ignore them or actually pay attention to them at your peril.
Well, as someone who once owned a Mona Gorilla t-shirt, I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you. I need it.
Okay. Henry Beard, along with Christopher Cerf, is co-author of the Encyclopedia Paranoica. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Paranoia, they destroy
it. One health problem that is no laughing matter is asthma. And the problem is worse in some lower-income communities. For example, New York's East Harlem section has the highest rate of asthma in the country. Many neighborhood and advocacy groups have brought attention to the problem in recent years, but the problem still persists, and there are no easy answers. Ray Lopez grew up and developed asthma as a child in the Bronx. Now, as an adult, Lopez helps families who are experiencing hazardous housing issues related to asthma. Lauren Bonner has more.
Ray Lopez spends most workdays outside the office and inside the homes of East Harlem families. Equipped with anything from a HEPA filter vacuum cleaner to an air purifier, Lopez decontaminates the homes of chronic asthma patients. His work helps relieve their symptoms. Lopez runs the environmental program at Little Sisters of the Assumption Family Health Services. He handles about 100 asthma cases having to do with indoor environmental problems. Mold is one of the more frequent complaints he receives. After 7 years on the job, Lopez says he's seen it all.
Just severe mold growth in multiple places, in the bathroom and in a hallway. And the leak was just to the point where the ceiling caved in. You know, it's a serious problem because there are multiple asthmatics there. One child is so severe that he's been moved to live with an aunt.
Lopez can relate. He too is asthmatic and must take extra precautions, like wearing a mask, when going into these homes. He developed the disease as a child growing up during the 80s in the Bronx.
I don't ever remember as a child being told about the connection between, say, cockroaches and mice or mold with asthma.
Since then, a lot has changed. The medical community has established scientific links between mold and some health problems. A 2003 study by St. Vincent's Hospital in Manhattan showed a correlation between spore counts and the likelihood of developing childhood asthma. Because of the toxic nature of some types of mold, exposure can aggravate and even cause asthmatic symptoms. But legislation is slow to help renters. The New York City Housing Department received 21,121 mold complaints in 2006, up from about 16,000 in 2004. The Housing Department will dispatch an inspector in 24 hours if the problem is severe, but there is no enforcement in the law that says landlords have to fix mold problems.
So there's no details given to them or procedures that they have to follow to address a mold problem. So they do the cheapest, easiest thing, which would be to plaster over a problem, paint over the problem.
It's not surprising that the problem persists in low-income neighborhoods. The buildings are old and poorly maintained. Dr. Hal Strelnick is a professor of family and social medicine at the Einstein School of Medicine and the author of several studies on the environment and asthma.
The issues of mold are often related to moisture and to leakage and to unrepaired plumbing problems that landlords are supposed to take care of. So you have a lot of different problems that have to do with poverty.
Last spring, the public advocate introduced a bill to reduce indoor allergens, specifically mold hazards. With the bill still in committee, Lopez won't be out of a job anytime soon.
That story comes to us from producer Lauren Bonner.
Still to come, making critical healthcare decisions should be a collaborative effort between you, your doctor, and, well, maybe some other people. That's next on The Health Show. You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you may have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow.
You can start your own Health Show archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1305.
This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Dealing with illness and disease often forces people to make complex and emotional choices. While it is natural and sometimes comforting for patients to value and rely on their doctor's advice in such frightening situations, the jargon that doctors can sometimes use can be confusing, and the variety of treatment options available doesn't clear up matters either.
In his new book, Critical Decisions, How You and Your Doctor Can Make the Right Medical Choices Together, Dr. Peter Ubel, a physician, Behavioral scientist and bioethicist at Duke University takes on this confusing and emotional topic in a way that tries to encourage all parties involved to redefine the doctor-patient relationship. Dr. Ubel spoke with the Health Show's Joe Donahue about the reason for writing this book.
Well, I got interested in this, been writing about this topic just because I struggle with it. I've struggled with it on both ends of the stethoscope. I've been a physician, but I've been a patient, and I've been the spouse of a patient, and I've seen how hard it is to get doctors and patients on the same page. And yet I know that the right medical decision is often not just a medical fact, but it depends on what a particular patient cares about. And so if there's not a good dialogue, a good exchange, a good conversation between doctor and patient, they might not make the right choice.
Do you think that it is often the patient's understanding that they don't have much say in the decision?
I think that's their belief. That's right. And I think, you know, when I go to my auto mechanic, I don't say, oh, you know, I think that wire, I'd put it that way or something, because I don't know anything about car engines, and I would trust my auto mechanic to do that. And I wouldn't tell my surgeon which scalpel to use. On the other hand, sometimes when the surgeon says, I think you need surgery, it might depend on whether you want to take the risks of surgery, and there might be alternative treatments that aren't so risky and so arduous to go through, and you are the one who knows what you care about, and so you have a role to play.
So how do you empower the patient?
Well, what I try to do is get people to just understand what it's like to be in these situations. So if they or their loved ones are in, you know, facing such choices, it won't be brand new. They'll have seen stories like it before. They'll be able to imagine it better, and that helps prepare. If you go into the doctor just expecting the doctor to kind of take over and tell you what to do, you might not be ready for that decision, and that's what I try to prepare people to do.
You also talk about the importance of really creating a team of people, of friends and family, and talk about the diagnosis, talk about the decision, because that network can then relay a lot of the stories that they have personally, and which helps in the ultimate decision-making process.
Oh, yeah, I even think you should bring loved ones to your visits if you can. And there are times where that might be uncomfortable or not what you want, but even going to a routine checkup, could be a lot of information coming your way in that 15-minute, 20-minute visit. And to have your spouse there, listening, asking questions, maybe asking questions you're too embarrassed to ask, that's a really helpful thing, have another set of ears and eyes.
Do you sense as a physician that when you are using terminology that a patient doesn't understand, can you detect when they don't understand it? Or is it really up to them to say, I don't understand that?
Yeah, no, it is. And it's strange to say, but you'd think you'd go in and if the doctor starts throwing a bunch of words at you, it's a really normal human reaction to feel overwhelmed, but to nod along like you understand. If the doctor says, do you have any questions, the polite thing to say is, no, doctor, thank you. But it's so important to understand what your doctor's saying. One of the things I really try to teach people to do is how to politely just ask questions or to say, you know, I didn't quite catch that. Can you say it again? I even think you can tape record your visits so you have a chance to listen to them again.
And then, as so many people do, even with tape recording, when you walk out, then you come up with all the questions that you wanted to ask when you had that few moments. So then do you ever get that chance again? How do you then, you know, nail the doctor down again to ask the questions that mean something to you?
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, if it's a doctor you're going to see again, of course, you can do that. Some doctors are increasingly accepting emails from patients for just these kinds of clarification questions. And I'd say if you're making an important decision, you don't understand everything going on, you have more questions, and the doctor doesn't have time to answer those questions, you might want to think about a different doctor.
Mm. You read about in the book, and I found it interesting, that if someone, say, for example, is deathly afraid of surgery, and they may not tell you that going in, but their whole apprehension, the whole reason that they are putting up roadblocks to things that you are discussing is because of this fear that they have. At what point is it on them to tell you that, and at what point should you be able to detect that?
All of us physicians need to strive to understand the world from our patient's perspective, to know what our patients are thinking and feeling. But that's a lot easier to say than to do.
Sure.
And so So while I try to give doctors tips in this book too, and I even try to push that we change medical education so doctors are better at picking up these signals, if you are the patient, assume unless you've said it out loud that your doctor doesn't know what you're thinking or feeling.
Do you have a sense that some of this is generational?
I think there are generational differences. I think my parents' generation, my parents around late 80s, they really were raised in an era that doctor knows best and do what you're told. And my generation, not so much. But I'll tell you, illness can age one pretty quickly. And when you get sick, you get scared, it's amazing how quickly you start wanting to defer to someone and just say, tell me what to do. It's a very normal response. I think one of the reasons you were such a good advocate for your parents isn't just generational. It's because you weren't the patient. Another reason to bring someone else in the room.
Because a lot of that just has to do with the relationship that you worry, you would worry about. I know when I was sick as a child, my mother would, you know, go through hell and earth to find out what the answers were to that question before she was going to put me on a table and let somebody go after me with a scalpel.
Sure. You know, when I was buying a car once, and I'd actually gone to one dealership a couple times and really liked this one dealer, and he didn't put a hard sell on me. Really, he was my type of sales guy, but I still wanted the price to be lower. So I brought a friend in because I felt like I liked the guy too much to be a good negotiator. And my friend came in, no compunction, just said, hey, let's talk about this price.
You talk about this in the book, that if you have time to decide, then take your time. But of course, you don't always have time. But if you have it, use it.
Amen. And sometimes when you feel like you don't have time, you should just ask and say, you know, I'd like a little more time. Can I sleep on this? Can I talk tomorrow with family and friends? And if they say no, you know, we really have to decide right now, well, okay.
How important is the second opinion?
It can be very important, but I think when you have a doctor and a good relationship and you feel like you understand your situation, you're in good hands. You should be lucky, and you're unlikely to find someone better on a second opinion.
I guess this is a question I should have asked you at the very beginning, but when it comes to critical decisions, what you term critical and what we term critical may not be the same thing.
Yeah, no, I actually think critical decisions can be quite mundane ones, like should I take that blood pressure pill? Should I make my blood sugar much lower like my doctor's asking me to? Even little things like that, there's pros and cons to them. There's good and bad things about them that you need to understand so you can decide whether that blood pressure pill or cholesterol pill is good for you. And it's critical to know that about every healthcare decision if you can.
And, of course, then there are the critical decisions that really are life and death, of this surgery versus that surgery or this procedure, that have a lot more riding on them.
Yeah, and that just ramps up the difficulty, like puts it on steroids, right? And it makes it that much harder because the emotions are stronger, the stakes are higher.
And going back to an earlier point of talking about patients bringing in different people and bringing in advocates and bringing in people, a team, if you will, that are interested in the outcome of this decision, that you as a physician like to see that, right? You want to see that Team Joe come in and talk about what the issues are, because then there's more ears, there's more information, and ultimately more questions that I assume you are asked.
Well, you've kind of put your finger on it there. I like it in theory, and often it's the best thing, but I'll tell you, there are going to be times where that's going to be hard for the physician if there's a bunch of people and they all have a bunch of questions and time is tight. And so that's why the more important this and more serious the decision and a major surgery you're going through, whether to go to the intensive care unit for advanced illness, whether to have chemotherapy for cancer that didn't respond to the first chemotherapy, you should have people to help you, and the doctor should be willing to take time.
Again, the name of Dr. Peter Ubel's new book is Critical Decisions, How You and Your Doctor Can Make the Right Medical Choices Together. He spoke with The Health Show's Joe Donahue.
That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org.
Want more? Then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org.
I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Stay healthy and be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.